Good afternoon. I'm Mary Hartnett, and you're listening to The Exchange. Last week, the Trump administration announced it would phase out the Deferred Action for Child Arrivals, or DACA, program if Congress failed to intervene within the next 6 months. And that announcement left many DACA-dependent immigrants panicking about their status. So today on The Exchange, we'll talk about the effects of rescinding DACA. With me are several people who know quite a lot about immigration law. Immigration lawyer from Sioux City, Heidi Oligmuller, is here, and she is here with Anna Mott, who is in the DACA program. Also with us is Sioux City immigration attorney Priscilla Forsyth, who has DACA clients as well. And with us also is the president of Northwestern College, Dr. Greg Christie. Thank you all for coming in. You know, I think I'll probably start with the attorneys here, and maybe we could talk a little bit about how DACA came about. I had talked previously with you, Priscilla, about this particular issue and how it came to a head last week and why.
Well, I think it's helpful to get an idea of where DACA started. DACA really came out of President Obama's frustration with Congress because they weren't passing the DREAM Act. They weren't doing anything to help the Dreamers. So he instituted DACA, which is, as he said time and time again, it's a policy. It wasn't a law. It wasn't passed by Congress. It was a temporary measure, and it was always intended to be a temporary measure to provide assistance to the Dreamers, as they're called, were generally the people who came to the United States when they were children through no fault of their own. But it was intended to provide them with a work permit and with it's not status, but at least they're protected. They're, anything that would happen to them is deferred. And the intention was Congress would pass a law, and this wouldn't last long, and it would go away. But it didn't, and so people have renewed it since that time. And now President Trump has said he's also frustrated with Congress. And essentially what he said is, I'm giving Congress 6 more months, and then it's going to end. But if you do have DACA, you can still renew if it expires before March 5th, 2018, as long as you file that application before October 5th of this year.
Heidi, what can DACA, people who are in that DACA program, do to protect themselves?
Well, really, their information has already been provided to the government through their DACA applications. So I've been telling my DACA clients to, until we see Congress do something, you know, make sure you can renew if you fall within the renewal time frame, but also look at any other avenues of relief that might be available to them. I agree with Priscilla. It wasn't meant to be a long-term benefit. I think the DREAM Act was introduced first in 2001, if I remember correctly. So it was over a decade that, you know, we've been sitting around waiting for Congress to do something. And so President Obama looked at, you know, who are these people? A lot of them are high school graduates, and then high school is done, and what do you get to do? You don't have a social security number. You don't have the ability to drive, all those things that come with adulthood and the rite of passage after high school. And so I've been just telling my clients, look for any other avenues. Make sure you stay, you know, apprised of any changes. Renew your driver's license for as long as you can. You know, things that would generally get you in trouble if you didn't take care of. But right now, I think, you know, the ball's in Congress's court, and hopefully something long-term can happen.
I would agree with Heidi on that. I do have a number of clients who do have other alternatives and other options. You know, perhaps they've gotten married to a U.S. citizen since they got DACA, and they may have some ways to apply for residency, or there may be other things that apply. So I'm also encouraging people who have DACA to meet with a lawyer, meet with someone who understands this as soon as possible to see what other options they have.
And Dr. Christie, you came out very much in opposition to President Trump's move to rescind DACA. Is that correct?
Yes. Like you've all said, this is an issue that's we've been kind of kicking the can down the road for a long time. And meanwhile, innocent people, men and women who came here as children, by no choice of their own, this has provided some protection for them. And people can argue, you know, whether that was done the right way or whatever. But the bottom line is, we need to care for these people among us. And I came out strongly in saying, as a Christian college, we support and we stand with these men and women, and they need a permanent, long-term solution to this. And it's well beyond time for Congress to act.
We were talking a little bit before the show about the economic effects of ending DACA.
Right. For some people, it's purely a pragmatic matter. We were talking before the show a little bit about just how we still have such low unemployment in general in our area, meaning Greater Northwest Iowa and even throughout the Midwest. But the Cato Institute did a study about what the effects would be if repealing DACA actually did happen. And they came up with a cost to the government of $60 billion and a cost to the economy over 10 years of over $200 billion. So there's real cost involved if all of a sudden these 800,000 some persons are no longer allowed to work, to be in our country, and we would feel the effects. Coming from Sioux County, where I live, we would definitely feel the effects of not having immigrant workers in our workforce.
Mm. Heidi, you have come with a person who's very much affected by DACA. Can you introduce her to us?
Absolutely. I have with me a longtime client and a wonderful person, Anna Mott. And if you'd allow, I'd like for her to share her story.
Yes, that'd be wonderful. We don't hear from many folks that are directly affected. So,
Hi, I'm Anna Mott. And my story started at 8 months old when my mother brought me over to the U.S. I resided in Sioux City mostly all my life. I graduated high school. Once DACA came out, I applied, and I've been holding a job ever since. 5 years now it's been. And thanks to DACA, I met my husband at my workplace, and that's about it.
But you're married now. Your husband, does your husband have citizenship?
Yes, he does.
So that sort of helps you out a little.
Yes. So hopefully in the timeline that DACA ends, I should be done with my, what is that called?
Petition.
You have a petition. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you're expecting a baby, and you already have a child who has some very specific medical needs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, she was born with a very rare condition, and it's very rare. It's called NAA10, and she's one of 20 in the world, so she needs a lot of medical help, and she sees a lot of doctors and stuff.
So it's important for her to stay
here, and for me as her mother to care for her and keep on top of all her medical needs and stuff.
But apparently the person that has to show hardship would be what, your husband?
My husband, yes.
Because children are not.
I
know one of you had talked about that.
Well, if you're applying, like if you have a U.S. citizen spouse, but you've been in the country illegally for a time period, you would have to get a waiver of inadmissibility, which says the government basically saying because your U.S. citizen or permanent resident spouse or parent has extreme hardship, if you're not here or if you have to go and leave the country to be with them, we're going to forgive you essentially for that time you were here unlawfully. For that purpose, they do not consider hardship to your child. So even if Anna's child has severe hardship, unless you can put it in terms of how that hardship would affect her husband, that's how she would need to do it to get a waiver. And I'm sure Heidi's got that under control.
Thanks, Priscilla. I'd like to add that in absence of a relative that could excuse or have your unlawful presence waived, the penalty's 10 years outside of the country. So were Anna not to have the ability to show hardship to her husband, if she wanted to actually complete the process and end up with permanent residency, it would require her to stay in Mexico for 10 years.
Mm. You're listening to The Exchange. Today we're talking about the effort by the Trump administration to rescind the DACA program and hand it over to Congress. And a lot of that was sparked by a lawsuit that had been taken up by the several attorneys general across the country of several states, including Nebraska. However, now the Attorney General of Iowa is one of several other attorneys general that have filed a lawsuit to enjoin the Trump administration from enforcing deportations as a result of DACA. And I talked to Attorney General Tom Miller earlier this week, and I have a little tape of him explaining why they decided to file that particular lawsuit. So here's Attorney General Tom Miller talking about that.
Well, there's a broad group of states involved from all parts of the country. California and New York are involved. In California, there are 200,000 of the 800,000 that would be affected, for instance. But states from around the country, Delaware, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, a broad group of 16 states that are taking this stand.
What kind of success do you think you'll have in basically, you know, stopping it where it sits now?
Well, you know, I hesitate to predict what courts will do. Courts aren't impressed by lawyers' predictions and when they go into court. So, you know, I'll let the court decide.
What was it about this that really bothered you? Was it the fact that some of these kids, some of these people that grew up here, basically going to school here, going to college here, working here, the fact that they might have all of this sort of go down the drain if they ended DACA?
Yeah. You have babies and other young kids coming over to America, admittedly illegally, unfortunately. But they grow up here and they get educated here and they work here and they abide by our laws and they pay their taxes. And now it's being proposed that they be deported back to the country that in many cases they don't even remember. That just strikes me as wrong. And in the words of former President Obama, cruel. I just don't think we should do that in this country.
If Congress was to take a second look at this, they could do something to make the DACA situation better. Maybe they could create a path for citizenship for these now probably a lot of them grown up people.
Yeah, it's now in the hands of Congress for 6 months, and it's really important that Congress act and provide that for the total and clear legality of the DACA program and make sure that this tragedy of potentially deporting 800,000 people that really grew up here and lived here and followed our law that they're not deported back to countries that they don't even remember. It is in the hands of Congress, and Congress must act and do a program here.
With all of the executive orders that President Obama made, and now the executive orders that are overturned and new ones made by President Trump, is it ever concerning the number of things that are done in this country via executive order? Do you think things would be easier if perhaps things were done differently, things were done by Congress?
Well, I mean, Congress has its role, and it's an extremely important role to pass the basic statutory law and fund the appropriations of government. But the executive is also an equal branch of government, and the executive does have the authority to do executive orders. You know, one can argue or be concerned that sometimes they go too far. But the existence of executive orders are very much part of the executive power that's grounded in our Constitution, well grounded in our Constitution.
That was Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller. He and several other states attorney general have signed on to a lawsuit asking the courts to enjoin the federal government and prevent it from deporting members of the DACA program when their status expires. Nebraska Attorney General Doug Peterson has taken the opposite stance. In fact, he and other attorneys general threatened to sue the government if it didn't announce plans to end DACA by September 5th. The threat of that lawsuit prompted the U.S. Attorney General to announce the phasing out of DACA if Congress doesn't act in 6 months. Peterson says the big concern states have is the misuse of executive orders. He says President Trump earlier this year reversed the deferred action for parents of Americans because Trump said it was unconstitutional, and Peterson believes that the same is true of DACA.
That's why we took this action, and that's why, although the DACA issues are so emotionally packed with some really, you know, heart-wrenching stories, our position was, look, that can only be done by Congress. So let's, the biggest thing I would say is to those who say, gee, Congress can't get it done, we have to go by the route of executive order. If you say that, then what are you going to say if the president, the current president, issues executive orders on other issues and expanding the law? Are you comfortable with that? Because the Constitution doesn't allow for that. We've got to be consistent, and that was one of the roles that we as attorney generals felt we needed to maintain, and that's why we issued the letter.
Well, how do you feel about the issue itself when it comes to these young people? They've been in this country all this time. A lot of them have gone to school here. What do you think Congress should do with this?
Well, that's the very thing. I think this is one unique issue in my mind where you have support from a variety of different organizations or individuals that cross party lines. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is in support of DACA legislation. You've had several different Republicans. There's been bipartisan support of an introduction of both a bill in the House of Representatives and also in the Senate called the Bridge Act. So you have these stories that are compelling regardless of Republican or Democrat. If there's ever a time where Congress should be able to take this information and also hear concerns on the other side of the issue, is now. And Congress should be able to take this and address it in an appropriate way. And that's far more constitutional than taking all of those very emotional stories. And I get that. I get the story of the three-year-old who came over here and now, you know, is got a college degree and is doing great things. She wouldn't even know what country or what community to go back to. That whole issue needs to be debated and wrestled with on floors of the House of Representatives and the Senate. It can't be just put in the president's hands and let them do what they're going to do.
Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller and other attorneys general across the country have filed a suit asking for the courts to enjoin the government from, stopping DACA, basically. What do you think about that?
It concerns me in the fact that I think our constitutional argument is pretty strong. And I think, you know, these issues are so powerful. This issue is so powerful that I see the roles of attorney generals as being to maintain the preservation of the constitutional balance of powers. I've not seen the pleadings by these AGs who have done this, but I think, and as you heard on national media, many people who had objectively evaluated this, now I recognize that there were several legal scholars who wrote a letter to Obama several years back, encouraging him to do the executive order. I would like to ask those scholars, are you comfortable today handing what you perceive as executive order power to the president? Are you comfortable turning that over to President Trump? And it's the same thing I would ask each one of the Democratic AGs who signed on this lawsuit. Are you comfortable giving the president of the United States this type of authority of executive order? Because it was never what executive orders were intended to do. You can study, you can go back and study the history of executive orders. If we allow executive orders to become another form of legislation, as apparently these Democratic AGs are willing to do, that's going to be a grave abuse, I think, of the Constitution.
And that was Nebraska Attorney General Doug Peterson explaining why he and other attorneys general threatened to sue the federal government if it didn't rescind DACA. He had a lot of points he raised in his discussion, and one of the biggest points, and I think I want to go around and ask all of you what you think about this, the use of executive orders. Why don't I start with Dr. Christie?
Well, I certainly don't fancy myself to be an expert on this topic, especially with two immigration lawyers in the room. But certainly, I think there's good points to be made there. I think that gets a little bit to the crux of this issue between the rule of law and what do we do in terms of what's right in the eyes of a human being. And from our perspective as a Christian college, we believe that each person is an image bearer of God and is worthy of care and concern, and especially those like Anna who came here before she was 1 year old, of no volition of her own. She's here with us now. We have a moral obligation to her and others like her. And so I think that for me is the issue. It's all upon Congress, and I would agree that it's really Congress's role, and I think we are where we are, because Congress has not acted on this for so long. I've been in this role 10 years. The first meeting I went to, listening to a town hall forum with Senator Grassley, people were asking him, what are you going to do about immigration reform? Here we are 10 years later, and we're still talking about it. So I think that, to me, is the crux of the issue.
Right, right. Priscilla.
I agree with you. I think one thing that's difficult with this issue of executive orders is that it's really a legal issue. It's really an issue of, was the way that President Obama started this program constitutional? And it's very hard when you have something as emotionally charged as the DACA kids and taking care of them, and you have that superimposed with a specific legal issue of how was this program created and was it done legally? So, you know, the other executive orders have already been rescinded. This was pretty much one of the last ones of Obama's executive orders that wasn't rescinded in the hopes that Congress would act. So I think that's an issue. And getting into, are you comfortable giving this power to President Trump, you know, if he can make an executive order because he doesn't agree with a law, maybe he'll say this class of people shouldn't have to pay taxes anymore, you know, and you should. I mean, I'm not saying he would ever do that, but he would have that same executive authority if you say President Obama had the ability to say immigration law I don't like won't be enforced as to this group of people.
Heidi.
Yeah, I would agree with what both of them have said. I would also add that something so complex and rooted so deeply in humanitarian issues shouldn't be left to the uncertainty of executive orders. So much like Priscilla said, and I liked the Attorney General of Nebraska statement, if you flip it around, how comfortable do you feel today with President Trump doing it? I mean, I was like, ooh, good point, you know? So, I mean, this is something so serious and so complex that you don't want every 4 years, every 8 years, for so much uncertainty to exist. The law is the law. Congress is the right body to make a long-term decision, a long-term solution, and I'd really like to see more effort and more pressure put on the appropriate body to do something long-term to benefit these people who really need it and who need the certainty rather than just, you know, this lawsuit was filed on this day and that day. It just adds to the uncertainty, the anxiety, and I feel like our effort could be focused in better places.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett, and we're talking about DACA and those affected by DACA with immigration lawyers Heidi Oleg-Mueller and also, attorney Priscilla Forsyth, who is also in Sioux City. We're also here with Anna Mott. She is a person with a DACA designation. And also we have Dr. Greg Christie with the president of Northwestern College in Orange City. You know, one thing I got out of talking with these two attorneys general was the huge politicization, I can't even say that today. It's very political, is what I want to say. This whole thing is now. And, you know, it sounds like people really want to have Congress do something. They had a poll come out just today. It says a majority of voters want Congress to pass legislation that allows undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to become citizens if they meet certain requirements. So, okay, like 65-70% of people they talk to, they want Congress to do something. Okay. In the last few days, in Congress, a representative from Colorado, he pulled back a petition that he had initiated to force the House to take up legislation on DACA. A Senate Judiciary Committee hearing into that issue was canceled this week. And a representative from Virginia, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, said he wouldn't move on any such legislation before he addressed the issue of criminal gangs, immigrant gangs, and border security. Now, I have to say, it seems like every time we try and do something, the political issues come up and it just gets stuck dead in its tracks. So I don't know what to do. What can be done to kind of force this forward? What do you think?
I think one thing we need to do is be clear about what the issue is. I listened to Attorney General Miller say that it's proposed to deport back all of these people. Well, that isn't what the proposal is. And in fact, if you go to the government website, uscis.gov, you can find some frequently asked questions. And one of them says that they will not specifically give the information about people who had DACA for enforcement purposes. Now, could they be removed from the country? Yes, but there's not going to be any affirmative move once DACA ends to provide that information to ICE. There are two different parts of the two different administrative agencies. So it's not so much a proposal to deport. It's really an attempt to force Congress to act. But I think we need to get our language. What are we talking about? We're not talking about someone wants to deport people. No, we're talking about what bill are you going to pass to protect them? You know, I think once we get the political terms in there and we get everybody all emotional, nothing's going to get accomplished because Congress is afraid to act. So I think everybody needs to take a step back and say, what do we need to do and try to be more practical about it?
Heidi, do you think that the individual states could play a role in pushing this forward? I mean, aside from lawsuits.
I think you already see a separation as far as what states have come out and said, and even cities have come out and said, oh, we're immigrant friendly, we're DACA friendly. I really would hate to see that. I think then what, everyone moves to Chicago or California? I mean, here in the Midwest, immigrants play a vital role in our economy, in our communities. And I agree with Priscilla. I think people need to get this story straight. What are we looking to do? And, you know, you really wish people would step back from their own personal agenda and say, well, first of all, let me understand DACA. So the one senator says, oh, I want to address the gang and the cartel issue. Absolutely. That's a huge crisis. But if you look at DACA, people that were even remotely considered to be affiliated with gangs were disqualified. So just once, I would love for people to fully understand what it is, or who are you talking about, what are you talking about, and what is the goal, rather than just, you know, picking out little segments that seem to support personal or political, you know, opinions or viewpoints. So really, I would hate to see it end up in the hands of the states. I think that goes back to uncertainty. What we enjoy about being the United States of America is generally we can travel from state to state, and in general, federal law applies to us all the same. So then you have someone who, let's say I live in California and they support DACA and the things. I'm stuck living in California my entire life. I feel like that's too much uncertainty, not a long-term solution. I really do hope that it seems like with the hurricanes and things like that, we've kind of fallen off focus very quickly as far as this time frame for Congress to act. There's going to be a lot of people whose work permits expire before that March 2018 deadline. I really hope they can keep their noses down and be focused on trying to come up with a solution before then.
If I can add one thing really quickly, when Heidi's talking about the gang members being disqualified, in my office, we referred to it as the Good Kids Act, because you couldn't have any felony convictions. You couldn't, if you had an OWI or a DWI or drug convictions, you're not going to qualify for DACA. So DACA really is a whole set of kids. They're, as I've called them before, the best and the brightest, who we really want to have these people in our society. They have a lot to give us and a lot to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to focus on that's who we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Christie, you were talking before about around Orange City. You mm-hmm. have a lot of people in the immigrant community from mm-hmm. many different places. What do you think it is? Sometimes in smaller communities where people know each other, there seems to be a way people get along and go along, whereas sometimes in bigger cities, things get very polarized.
That's a good question. I think, you know, in our particular community, we do have a very strong value system, I think. And maybe that's true for a lot of small communities. I can't say that. I've lived in a number of different sized communities, but the last 10 years I've lived in Orange City. And I think in our community, which would also consider itself to be a very compassionate community, large number of folks who are church going or church attending, large number of adoptions, both domestically, internationally. So I think in our particular community, I think there is a sense of caring for one's neighbor that is very much real thing. And I think it doesn't matter whether that person is, what their skin color is, where they came from, what their background, what their ethnicity. I think there's a sense that, you know, all of us were created in God's image. And I think that in a small community, we rely on each other. We actually do talk to our neighbors, and we actually do, and we rely on each other, as I mentioned earlier, too, for work in a small community. You need everybody involved in helping the community grow and prosper.
Right. And this is such a, on the local level, state level, it's different than the national level. On the national level, in the Congress, it's a political hot potato, and people are very worried, I think, of, you know, having their fingerprints on it when it's all over.
Right.
And there's a fear.
Right. I think, you know, something else I'd like to bring up, maybe just changing a little bit, or maybe it goes back to a little bit we were talking about in terms of what's the real issue here, or what, you know, how do we stay on point? I think we have with the hurricanes and all that. I think it's all of a sudden it's gotten sidestepped a little bit. I read a piece written by President of Rutgers, which is obviously in a large urban area, but with equal concern about this issue. And I think he makes a great point in what he wrote, talking about the fact that, you know, we as a country, regardless of how we got to this point, one of my jobs as a leader is define reality, and also is to speak out for those who don't have a voice. And I think that's exactly what this person was trying to do, the president at Rutgers, but said basically, you know, as has been mentioned, these persons who registered with DACA, they were asked to come out of the shadows, so to speak. They were asked to come out, report all their information to the government, and just like was said before, mentioned already, people who are, they could not be convicted of any serious crime whatsoever. So now that they've done this, ending the program would really be not only wrong, it would be unwise, and it really would be against our American values, I think, to make a promise as a country to these individuals and now pull out the rug from underneath them. I think that would just be wrong, and from my standpoint, even against our Christian values. It's just not how we treat one another. So I think that's why this is so important. It's becoming upon Congress to act, and to act in a way that I think the American people are waiting for Congress to step up and do the right thing.
Priscilla and Heidi, what do you two think about all of the protests that were generated right after this announcement was made? What kind of value do you think there is when they have these protests? Does it help?
I wish I could bottle up people's energy and time and be like, can we just, I think personally, if I were a DACA, and I always call him kid, I'm glad Priscilla did too, because I always like, I'm sorry, but your birthday's when I graduated high school. I feel like, you know, you have people who feel like if someone's not going to fight for me, I need to fight for myself. And like Anna here telling her story, and she said before we went on the air, I feel like this is my way to be useful and my way to do something. And so you know, there's definitely benefit in getting the stories out. I wish we wouldn't look again at it as some big lump sum picture, because you have individual lives that we're talking about, and some people's stories are really, really compelling. And if I were on the fence as a congressman, some stories like Anna's would, I just can't imagine turning a blind eye to those things. So, you know, there's always a place for protests, I guess. I think since the November election, they've almost become, people have become numb to them a little bit. And so the effectiveness has potentially been lost. But I definitely admire those who are in a really vulnerable situation that they're willing to step up and fight for themselves. I admire and respect that.
Priscilla?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Heidi said. I honestly don't think the protests are effective. In my opinion, what's more effective is to take that energy and organize yourselves. Get together the stories like Heidi's talking about. And instead of, I heard of a group that was trying to occupy Joni Ernst's office. Well, instead of doing that, why don't you get together and put out some persuasive information to provide to her and try to be productive about it. None of us react to being bullied well. And it's kind of like, to me, a lot of the protesters feel like they're bullying. They're trying to bully people to do what they want. And I understand where their feelings are coming from, and I understand they're doing what they think is what they can do. But there are more productive ways to channel that energy, to make your voice heard, and to try to be persuasive and convince our senators and our congresspeople that this is what has to change. You know, I think a lot of people look at DACA as being a program that was intended to be permanent. It wasn't. But what we need to do is start the program in Congress again. This is really a Dream Act issue. You know, we're in support of the Dreamers and the Dream Act. DACA was a temporary fix. Let's focus our energy, put together your stories, get all the people together. And the one other thing I say is, you know, have your friends, your family members, people who are citizens, call the representatives and senators and just say, I want to support the Dreamers. That will be noted. That's a way. They don't have to go outside. They don't have to tell anyone else. But that there'll be a little hash mark made in favor of Dreamers, and it'll tell your senators and your representatives how you feel.
I couldn't agree with that more. And because of my position, I have the privilege of going at least once or twice a year to Washington to meet with our senators and our representative and their staff members. And so I've been in touch with all the offices, Senator Grassley, Senator Ernst, and also Representative King. And that's exactly what my approach has been, too. I think having worked and been on Capitol Hill for the last 20, 25 years of my career, that does make a difference. I think that it's much more effective than doing a protest in the street or doing a sit-in in somebody's office. But if you make the case for why this is important and share individual stories of how this is impacting real people in their everyday lives, I think that is what our legislators need to hear, and they need to hear a sense of urgency from us that you know, empty promises. You know, many Congresses have come and gone and not dealt with this issue. Now we have a timeline. It must be dealt with this next 6 months.
Yeah, why don't we hear, before we go, from the Dreamer in Residence here. We have Anna Mott here, and you've been sitting there listening patiently. What do you think? I mean, what do you think the level of urgency is? I mean, for you personally here.
Well, as for me, you could say, like, you know, I'm considered semi-safe because, like I said, before my DACA expires, I should be having my new residency. But there's still other people out there who don't have that luck, and it's not like you're going to tell them, go marry a resident or citizen, you know? It's, what are they going to do? And the best thing I can do is inform people of my story and just tell people. For example, some people wouldn't know I was a DACA recipient until I told them, and they're like, what? You know, we're everyday people. We work with you. We go to church. You see us everywhere, and you wouldn't even know. So best thing to do is inform people of you know, what we do here and how we contribute.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it, because there's certainly a lot of political rhetoric about this, but not many real people who are affected by it being heard.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because there's fear, too.
I mean, you don't walk around saying I'm a DACA recipient. For me, it's the best way I could help.
Exactly. Well, today we have been talking about all the events around DACA and the efforts to rescind it as of last week. And with me today, I've had the president of Northwestern College, Dr. Greg Christie. And thank you to Doctor, for coming and being part of our show and sort of sharing a little bit with us what you deal with all the time.
Well, it's a pleasure. I appreciate being invited, and I especially appreciate Anna coming and being willing to come out. And my heart goes out to you and thousands of others like you. And so I'm honored to be here with you.
Yeah, and thank you, Anna, and also thank you to immigration lawyers Heidi Oleg Mueller and also Patricia Forsyth for
Priscilla.
I'm so sorry. Did I call you Patricia?
Yeah.
I did. Priscilla and Heidi, thank you so much. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm going to switch gears a little here. Lamb Theater will present the regional premiere of Ken Jones' Alabama Story on Friday, September 15th. Jones joined the We Are Not a Monolith's Ike Rayford and Shelby Pierce by Skype to talk about the play's genesis, as well as how it's become surprisingly relevant to today's political environment.
I do have to tell you that this is really awesome for me, because I actually am in the play.
Excellent. That's great.
It's an honor to have you on the show. Kenneth, can you tell us a little bit about the play?
I was in 2000, I was reading the New York Times obituary section, like you do, and I came across an obituary of a librarian that many people have never heard of named Emily Reed. And Emily Reed was a librarian in 1959, Montgomery, Alabama, who was committed to protecting books, as librarians all over the world, that's their mission. And there was a children's picture book called The Rabbit Wedding that was about a black bunny rabbit that marries a white bunny rabbit. And in the segregated South of 1959, you can imagine that some people might not have liked the image of different colored rabbits
marrying
in a moonlit meadow.
Yeah.
And so there were some politicians and conservatives and others who viewed it as, you know, a brainwashing technique to get children to embrace the idea of mixing of the races. Emily was persecuted by politicians at the time, particularly one politician who said that the book ought to be burned, which, you know, is inflammatory to say the least. I felt when I read this obituary of Emily Reed that it was instantly a play. I thought there were amazing elements to her story, her real life story. She was not from Alabama. She was a Southern woman. She was born in North Carolina, but she was raised mostly in Indiana, which identified her not as Southern. So the play really began to form in my mind very quickly. It became about being an insider and an outsider and a woman and a man and black and white and North and South and personal and political, and all of that kind of became the part of the soil that grew this play.
There's a couple things here. One, this is your first play that you wrote, right?
That's right. Yes. I before this, I had written a couple of musicals, and but really this was the, and I have some plays in the drawer, but this was really the passion project for me. It stuck with me for many years. I did a lot of research over the years, and I was lucky enough that I got some opportunity with it, and a couple of theaters picked it up for development, which means, you know, readings and workshops. And then I had a world premiere of it in 2015 at Pioneer Theater Company in Salt Lake City, one of the great sort of American regional theaters.
You know, first and foremost, it's a beautiful story. And even as I am, preparing myself to play a role in this play, I each rehearsal, I'm finding something more beautiful and I'm discovering something. And so the research that you put in here was just, I mean, can you tell us about that?
Over the year 1959, between January and December, when she was persecuted by a state senator, they even tried to legislate her out of a job by changing the job qualifications of the state librarian. She was the state librarian of Alabama. So there was lots of reporting in papers. This also made national news and international news. Time Magazine, New York Times, were all reporting about this story. So I had firsthand, not firsthand accounts, but certainly reported comments by both Senator Eddins, his name was E.O. Eddins, and Emily Reed, and there's a wonderful interview with her. I think the AP did it, where she says, "I believe that the free flow of information is the best means to solve the problems of the South, the nation, and the world." And it's such a beautiful sentence. It's such a beautiful American sentence because it really is touching on First Amendment and freedom of ideas and freedom of thought and freedom to, and, you know, access to read. I also went down south. I went to Alabama and drove around Montgomery and toured the state capitol. I think much like an actor likes to dip into roles and do research, I dipped deeply into this and drove through Alabama and was really inspired. It's a very beautiful country.
You wrote this play, over, 10, 15 years ago, or started at least, and mm-hmm. and now with what we see going on, and I mean, it's just an eerie parallel.
Yeah, I never would have predicted that there would be so many shifts in politics, so quickly. It's the intolerance and ugliness that's displayed in the play from 1959, I didn't think would return to us, and some of that has returned to us today. The senator, I've renamed the senator as Senator Higgins, right, rather than Eddins, just to protect Mr. Eddins' family,
right,
and to allow for the fact that he may have changed. But he's described as being someone who's never wrong and never sorry. And there was a production of the play in Detroit last fall, and I was sitting in the audience, and Emily Reed says to him, "You are never wrong and you are never sorry." And the senator says, "If I'm never wrong, what have I got to be sorry for?"
Right.
And I think that is a unique moment in our American experience right now. So, It's. I'm hoping that the play is universal. I'm hoping that it's timeless, but truth is stranger than fiction.
Kenneth, I know with myself, I sometimes have a hesitation to engage in when something is marked as civil rights era, because I know I'm going into something really heavy.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to, I say that the play is set in the deep south of the imagination. There's a narrator. It's very theatrical. It gives me permission to be playful and mix up some scenes. And Emily is sort of challenged in a kind of courtroom scene, and sort of melded into that scene is a flashback scene between the boy and the girl from the past. And I wanted to play with theatricality and I didn't want to write docudrama. That's no fun. But I also did want to play with a lot of different theatrical genres and, that I think the audience will really, understand because they've seen a lot of these elements before. There's a courtroom drama. There's a romance. There's a workplace drama. There's a comedy element to it. I steal from the best, there's a hint of Tennessee Williams in this, and there's a big dollop of Thornton Wilder. If you like Our Town, the theatricality of Our Town, this has kind of got elements of that. I'm really pleased that people laugh a lot at this play, and by the end they're in tears because it's,
I'm
That was Ike Rayford and Shelby Pierce of We Are Not a Monolith. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.